What I want is immediacy. The nub of the moment pressed without doubt into my side. The tremor that comes sometimes before sight, before taste, or touch. Whatever might be lost, don't take away from me. Stars pouring out of the firmament, not ever holding back the flood over my small ladle. Louisa A. Igloria, in her book, The Buddha Wonders If She's Having a Midlife Crisis. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is poet Louisa A. Igloria. Louisa is the recently appointed Poet Laureate of Virginia, an honor well deserved. She is also the author of 14 books of poetry and 4 chapbooks. Originally from Baguio City in the Philippines, Louisa now makes her home with her family in Virginia, where she is professor of creative writing and English at Old Dominion University. From 2009 to 2015, Louisa was also director of the MFA Creative Writing Program at Old Dominion. Louisa's poetry has been published in numerous anthologies and journals in Canada and the UK, as well as Australia and the United States. And finally, she is the winner of numerous poetry and literary prizes here in the US and in the UK. Louisa, congratulations on your selection as Poet Laureate of Virginia. It's an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Hal. I'm very happy to be here. And thank you for all the good words of introduction.
Oh, you're very nice. Thank you. Please tell us what it means to be Poet Laureate of Virginia. What will your responsibilities be? And how will you define your tenure in office? And let me add one more comment. How will the virus and the lockdown affect your work as Poet Laureate?
Right. Well, the position of Virginia Poet Laureate is honorary. There is no compensation. And it was established in 1936. And it was only beginning in 1998, I believe, that the governor appointed a poet laureate from a list of nominees presented by the Poetry Society of Virginia. I read somewhere that the poet laureate should encourage the exchange of arts, information, and perspectives on poetry, but is not actually obligated to write any verse during their tenure, which I thought was interesting. But I got the communication I received from the governor's office telling me that I had been selected included this paragraph, and I quote, "Governor Northam is focused on building a commonwealth that works better for all people, no matter who they are or where they live. During your term, you will assist the governor in solving real problems real people face." So that was a bit more definition of the role of Poet Laureate. And I thought about poet Martin Espada, who talks about poetry like bread. And Martin Espada himself has written about the struggles of immigrants, the powerless, those who are considered other in the United States. And then recently, I was reading a story in the Atlantic about former U.S. Poet Laureate Natasha Trethewey, who has a new memoir just out. And she talks there about her ability, about poetry's ability to help us survive grief and trauma. So I think I like this idea, this belief that the laureateship is a unique position for this kind of service and engagement through poetry. And I hope to have many conversations with others to find meaningful ways to support and promote the voices of Virginian poets in particular, and the work of poets and poetry in general as an important part of living in our times. And you mentioned the pandemic, and because of the pandemic, it probably won't be possible to travel through the state for a long while. I know predecessors have given readings across the state, participated in all kinds of programs, given what we are experiencing today, I think that the way to go is through virtual programs such as this, so we can offer programs and workshops and panels and other kinds of poetry events that I hope will center around the theme that other writers have also affirmed, and that is how poetry and creativity are not luxuries, but are necessary for our survival. And the Poetry Society of Virginia, and I am a member also, they spoke recently of wanting to develop a program of youth ambassadors for poetry. And I would like to see how I can also help with that.
And that will be done through a virtual approach as well.
Yes, and I will try to reach out to as many poets and supporters of poetry as I can in the next 2 years.
Well, Louisa, as a poet of color and also an immigrant, what does this appointment mean to you? And also, what does it mean for Virginia?
All right. Well, when immigrant poets of color, and multilingual poets approach prospective publishers, we are often asked how our work would be accessible to the so-called default universal audience. And so sometimes we've been told that our communities are not readers anyway, or that they don't buy books, so why should they publish us? So I'm grateful to the poets of color who have shown the way and who continue to affirm for all of us that our work is important and that our voices matter. So looking at the list of poet laureates on the national level, there have been 23 U.S. poet laureates since 1937. And of the 23 U.S. poets laureate, there are only 5 poets of color. So Rita Dove, Natasha Trethewey, Juan Felipe Herrera, Tracy K. Smith, and our current U.S. poet laureate, Joy Harjo, who is also the first Native American poet laureate. So out of 20 Virginia poets laureate, Rita Dove was also the first African American, both U.S. poet laureate and the first poet laureate for Virginia. And with Sophia Starnes, who is of Spanish and Filipino ancestry, my friend and retired colleague Tim Siebels, and myself, now there are 4 poets of color who have been appointed to this distinguished state laureate position. And I'm very proud to add to that number because I think it also reflects some of the changes which we are seeing everywhere, not just in our country, but also across the globe.
Well, you mentioned that, and let me come back to the last part of that question. How is this appointment and the appointment of poets of color important for Virginia? Why is it important for Virginia that you and other poets of color are recognized?
Well, we know that Virginia is the seat of many important historical markers in our history, and to see that there are poets of color recognized in the slate of poet laureates, I think signifies that we are trying to look more closely at the place of other communities who have often been marginalized in our society, in our culture, and to do something about according them the place that they deserve in this history that we are all supposed to be part of.
Well, you mentioned the default audience. What is the default audience that publishers look for?
Well, I would say it's typically a white audience. And sometimes when people of color do things like introduce their own vernacular, their own indigenous language and perspectives, it feels as though they have to fight hard to even justify why they're doing that, whereas they should not have to do that.
But what I find interesting for Virginia is that, and maybe you just alluded to it, is that poets of color bring a perspective to this default audience that they are not going to get in other places. They bring another outlook, another way of seeing the world. Now, most poets do that out of their own experience and their own insights, but poets of color for this white default audience, it seems to me, would bring a much needed and important perspective to this world. Am I off base here, or is that something that is meaningful to you as a poet of color?
Yes, it is. And I think at heart, what I try to remember is that poetry is really interested in communicating the inexpressible, the places where our feelings are very complex and rich and nuanced, and they can't be neatly labeled as belonging to either just one or the other kind of category. So all of the ways in which our human experiences are shaded by our particular histories and experiences, we bring that to literature, we bring that to our use of language and the writing of our poems. And in that sense, that is probably the more universal base to look at, and not the idea that there's a default culture which predominates, but that is the reality that we experience in publishing, in education, and in other systems that we experience in our culture.
It simply now reflects the reality of our culture. Mm-hmm. In your swearing-in ceremony, you said that in this time of pandemic and our isolation, that you were concerned with poetry as witness. But what do you mean when you say poetry as witness?
Well, I think what I said was a poetry of active witness was something I wanted to see, that I could work with people to kind of bring this to the foreground. And Tracy K. Smith just said in the slowdown, I think this past Monday, and I quote, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Black lives matter, but it feels wrong to say nothing." And it feels wrong to say nothing, especially during this time when we're seeing an increase in acts of open racism and authoritarianism. It's not right to get into a vehicle purposely to mow down a crowd of peaceful protesters. It's not right to spit in the face of a restaurant or store worker who politely asks you to wear your face mask. It's not right to shoot a 12-year-old carrying a toy gun in a park, and I'm referring to Tamir Rice. It's not right to shoot a woman asleep in her bed 8 times, I'm referring to Breonna Taylor, and then produce an incident report stating that she sustained no injuries. It's not right to separate children from their parents whose only so-called crime was to seek asylum in a different country. It's not right to detain hundreds of these migrant children in camps where the facilities don't meet basic standards of care and where the coronavirus is now also rampantly spreading. It's not right to manipulate the law in order to make it easier to arrest people without warrant or detain them without charges or stifle the ability of citizens to speak or write legitimately against the evils and abuses that they see in society. So, you know, I had barely hit my teens in the Philippines when the late dictator Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law. So I remember those times very well. People lived through days and nights of curfew, the constant threat of surveillance, the disappearance of loved ones. When we would hear news of a salvaged body, we knew that this was someone who was not saved or rescued, but rather someone who had been taken away and killed, likely by the military, and then the body dumped somewhere in an alley or in a canal or a river. And today we hear of the more than 25,000, I think now, EJKs or extrajudicial killings in the Philippines under Duterte's regime, with many of the victims young people and children below five. So the mind tries to wrap itself around these things, and it is just so difficult to make sense of it. In his powerful book, Ilya Kaminsky, whose work I love, his book, Deaf Republic, describes a fictional town under siege where the people enact resistance through deliberate silence and deafness, and they also resist through art. So one of the characters runs a puppet theater which delivers messages of insurgency. But as far as the poetry of witness phrase goes, I think it may have been the Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegria who was among the first to use this phrase. And American poet Carolyn Forche has translated her work. And she also, Forche also speaks of this kind of poetry as one written in the aftermath of extremity. So it's one, this is a kind of poetry that looks at and describes violence and atrocity in the world, but in describing it, is interested in searching for those traces or evidence of our humanity. And in my acceptance speech, I mentioned that poets who happen to teach in colleges or universities like myself are sometimes viewed as writing a merely academic poetry or a theoretical poetry, and that they're thought to live in some kind of bubble that's separate from real life, but it's just not possible to live in the world and be completely unaffected by what goes on in it. So some people write and make art. Some of us minister to the sick or work in the front lines. Some of us teach. Some organize marches and other public actions. Nevertheless, there are many different ways to witness, which is just another way to say that what we really need to do is to try to find ways to do and say what's right.
Well, I certainly understand that. And you also mentioned that you wanted to write poetry or express what it means to take care of the other. Mm-hmm. And say something about that. And and then you read a poem. Would you share that with us, Louisa?
Yeah, certainly. I had read a poem called Ode to the Hand Wrapped Around the Achilles Heel. And as we know, the reference is to the story of the Greek hero Achilles, who during the Trojan War killed the Trojan prince Hector. And all of this sets off a retaliatory cycle of violence. But in recalling that story, I wanted to focus on not just the big moments of heroism or struggle. In those narratives, those are the things that are usually what you look at first. But there are those other moments of heroism and internal tension that are more subdued or that aren't given as much screen time. And maybe it's because I have children, but I'm riveted by the figure of Achilles' mother and how she held him by the heel as an infant and dipped him into the river Styx when he was a baby, right? Because she wanted to protect him from harm. So that gesture of wanting to shield someone, because we know that pain and suffering are, you know, pretty unbearable things, and we would like to not have the people we love the most, especially, have to experience those kinds of things. So all of that went into the poem that I wrote, which is not really about Achilles, but goes and looks at some of those features of the story that speak to this idea of wanting to shield someone, to protect someone, to try and provide security.
Well, read that for us, Louisa, right, if you would.
I'll do that. Ode to the hand wrapped around the Achilles heel. Good husband material, her aunt's assessment, watching her fiancé help his parents navigate the narrow staircase from the gallery, where they've gone to an art opening. He goes out in the rain to get the car, which he parked at the end farthest from both entrance and exit, lessening the off chance a lorry or fire truck or other large vehicle might lose its brakes, swerve from the road, and ram into theirs. Over the years, she comes to learn how certain habits and the ways he likes to do things are driven by a combination of fear, planning, and precision, even if, or perhaps because, most things are outside the realm of total human jurisdiction. In the Iliad, their son in her arms, Andromache pleads with Hector not to go back to fight in a war that he opposes. But he is the kind of man for whom duty to country is synonymous with obligation to family. He will do what he can to prevent their being taken as spoils of war or slaves. Homer writes, 1,000 campfires gleamed upon the plain. When it is his time to go, he only wants to go with honor, because victors in any kind of war don't always have compassion. Achilles gloats, not only calling on dogs and vultures to desecrate the corpse of his enemy, but also slitting his heel tendons, passing leather thongs through them before dragging Hector's body in the dust. This story is meant to illustrate weakness in any figure, victor or victim. Thus, every human fear of the end is a wish to protect, to render secure, if not invincible, whoever is in their care. Here is the ankle held fast in the mother's hand, the one blind spot her love kept dry from the waters of the underworld. Here is the rain that falls on all their heads with not a shield in sight. And always someone who volunteers to go first or last.
Beautiful, Louisa. You gave us a little bit of your sense of this poem at the beginning of it in television talk they call the setup. But I wonder if you would come back to it again and talk to us for a moment about what you were trying to create with this poem.
I think I wanted to create a connection to stories that seem only mythical or only stories, but that we actually see constantly played out in different versions in, you know, many different parts of our lives. So it's also, it's a mythological story, but it's also a very domestic and familiar story to us. If you're a parent, you know what it means to agonize over the safety of your children, and vice versa. If children, you know, worry about their parents, they also wish to do things to protect them. Especially in the pandemic, we're seeing a lot of that with, you know, we are being warned to stay away from those who are immunocompromised, because just being around them, even if you're young and healthy, could put them in jeopardy. So it's this idea of keeping an eye out for the other, which is the cornerstone of empathy, I think.
Well, it's also, I would suggest, it's also the cornerstone of community, and the cornerstone of how we make a creative society. So back to the pandemic, we have never been more in a place. It seems to me, and I'll ask your thought, in a place where we need more to care for each other. And it goes down to the simplest things, like wearing your mask, keeping your distance. I mean, these are mundane things now, but it's interesting that in the severity of this pandemic, we have to talk about the mundane now as things we must do.
For sure. And they seem very basic, simple things, but on some level, they seem maybe the hardest to do, because I think a lot has also happened in modern societies, so that we feel like maybe it's harder to get in touch with our feelings because there's so much distraction and noise around us. And I think what this pandemic period has done is to, again, strip away all the unessential things and force us to look at what's truly important.
Louise, I know you publish, in addition to your books, you publish a bit online. Would you tell our listeners where they might find your poetry online?
Yes, for nearly 10 years now, I write daily poems, sometimes more than one, but I post only one poem a day. And these are ongoing works in progress, and this is a blog for poetry, which was founded by poet and publisher Dave Bonta. So you can find it at vianegativa.us, no spaces in between via and negativa. So what my daily writing practice has done is to give me a way to, I think poetry is really my favorite way to process my thoughts. I go there to work out things that I happen to be thinking about. I don't have any fixed time of day when I come to this. I don't have any fixed subject in mind, but I try to just engage, you know, my whole being, my thinking, my feeling, in the act of looking for language to express what it is that I'd like to give voice to.
Louisa, I want to congratulate you again on your appointment as Poet Laureate of Virginia. And thank you for joining me today on Delmarva Today. And I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.